Tonight on Arena, Lisa O'Neill is in session with songs for that are very timely, and The Vast of the Night, The High Note and Only the Animals are the movies up for review. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Films first this evening. The High Note is set in the world of the LA music scene. The Vast of Night is an ode to 1950s sci-fi. And Only the Animals charts an unhappily married woman's terrifying fate and her mysterious connections to five other people. John McGuire and Angela Flannery have been viewing and they're talking to me this evening about the three movies. We'll start with The Vast of Night, debut film from director Andrew Patterson. When this started, John, I thought I was getting some sort of homage to War of the Worlds. Yeah. And that's certainly what's involved. We're in that period. We're in that kind of hysteria.
That's right. This is, like you say, Sean, a debut from Andrew Patterson, a self-taught filmmaker in his early 30s. It's as good a debut film as I've seen all year. And like you say, there's shades of Orson Welles' War of the Worlds and The Thing and The Blob and They Came from Space and all of those 1950s Red Scare alien invasion movies added to Spielberg's Close Encounters and the BBC Radiophonic Workshop LPs. It's some list of credentials. And this is a story that was written by James Montagu and Craig W. Sagner as an homage. But this is territory that's been well covered over the last 70 years. But these guys managed to find a new angle and in Patterson's presentation managed to make it seem fresh and exciting. I thought it was great. I really enjoyed it.
Angela, radio is a very important aspect of the story here, but I believe the first 20 minutes or so were quite a struggle for you. What was it that threw you off?
I suppose it was just the assault on your ears for the first 20 minutes, Sean, because the opening scene is in the small town high school basketball arena of the high school. And it is as people are coming in. And so you can imagine the acoustics in there. It's rubber-soled shoes. It's, you know, equipment being banged around. And the lead character in it, Everett, we meet him first and he's got a cigarette hanging out of his mouth and he's mumbling and speaking really quickly. And there's all sorts of confusion and miscommunication going on as they're trying to get this basketball game going. And he's been followed by the female lead, the two-hander essentially, Faye, who has this very high-pitched kind of whittering voice. And I mean, it really is very, very noisy and very intense and quite irritating. I was very on edge watching it. And that goes on for kind of 15 minutes. And then the two of them leave and walk through the town. And it continues in this very high speed exchange of information about technology because she's a bit of a science nerd and he's a radio nerd. And I mean, really, you know, sitting there watching it, you feel like you're being blinded by science. And it took me a while to go, this has got to be deliberate because I'm really uncomfortable just with the assault, the auditory assault of it. But of course it is completely deliberate. And if you stick with it for those 15 minutes, boy, does it pay off. I'm really glad I did stick with it.
Yeah, because sometimes you don't even know who the characters are. It took me a long time to work out who was actually talking to whom and what they were saying. Their backs were to the camera for quite a lot of it, which was quite a brave move in some ways. But that radio aspect, John, becomes vital, in fact, to the way Patterson tells the story.
It's the whole mechanism by which these two nerds, and they're the closest thing you got to nerds in the 1950s. One runs his own little one-room radio station. The other is a switchboard operator, played by Sienna McCormick. And what happens, the way that they, in their rural, isolated New Mexico town, they become aware of something happening outside in the wider world is through strange frequencies and eerie oscillating tones that they find first on the phone lines at the switchboard and then interrupting the radio signal at the studio. And calls start coming into the switchboard. Terrified people have seen things in the sky. And then another call comes into the radio studio that suggests a cause for the sound and sets in train a kind of a treasure hunt to solve the mystery, or if not solve it exactly, to intensify the mystery.
Right. And that call that comes through comes from a character called Billy, played by Bruce Davis. And in the clip I'm about to play, Faye, played by Sierra McCormick, has put the call through to Everett, played by Jake Horowitz. He's on air. And Billy is going to give some information about the sounds that they have been hearing.
Everett, we got a caller.
Put him through.
He's from out of town. It sounds like I might know something.
Then put him through now, Faye. Come on, please.
Sir, we are connecting you now.
Hello, sir. This is Everett Sloan. Can you hear me?
Hello, yes. How are you?
I'm good. Can I get your name?
Yes, my name is Billy.
Billy. Okay, thank you, Billy. And I need to tell you first, we don't allow any swear words or inappropriate stories on the air. I could lose my job. And I don't have a delay here, and I want to put you right through onto the air, but I need you to promise me that we're safe in doing so.
Of course, I understand. I don't swear talk like that anyway in my life.
Okay, I'm breaking the rules to do this, so please, you know, be honest with me. Maybe ask me if you think something needs to be discussed off the air, and I'll go to a break and put on a record, all right?
Okay, I can do that.
All right, well, we are going on the air here shortly in 3, 2, 1.
And we're back, everybody. Sorry to cut that last song short, but we do have a caller here who may know something. Now, Billy, would you mind telling us all what you know?
Billy, played by Bruce Davies. Everett, played by Jake Horowitz. He's the radio host. And Sierra McCormick, the telephonist there, playing the character of Faye, the telephonist, rather, who puts the call through to the radio. Angela, you were saying you were really glad that you stuck with it, but I just want to stick with that phone call for a moment. That's entirely in voiceover. We never see the character who makes the phone call. We just see the reactions of Jake Horowitz to the call. And I don't know if the camera moves very much during maybe 5 or 6 minutes of that phone call. It's very brave in that respect.
It is. It's very experimental. It is, as you say, very, very brave, but it's so effective as well. I mean, I think it's about 5 minutes long, and it is just, you know, the camera is on the Everett character and it is all about the audio. And then suddenly it fades to black. So you can imagine if you're sitting in a cinema watching this, you are going to be in pitch blackness. And for 2 minutes, you just have the voice of Bruce Davies. And what an amazing voice actor he is. Mm. I mean, you're really transported with it. It's a very ambitious thing to do. It could have fallen flat on his face, but it actually works really, really well. People who like radio are going to love this film, particularly people who have an interest in old radio, you know, sort of the early days of radio. And, you know, I don't know anything whatsoever about Jake Horowitz. I think this is a screen debut. He just did an incredible turn as the local radio star, you know, when he goes into persona once he's on air, he starts reading out all of the show sponsors, calling out requests. He knows all of the listeners because they're, you know, it's local radio. There's a competition to win a square of Elvis Presley's carpet, which of course is a fake. It's just fantastic. Yeah. It kind of brings, if anyone knows Garrison Keillor, WLR Radio Romance, that novel, it brought me right back into that. And I mean, I love radio, so I loved it. So if you're a radio nerd, you're going to like this movie.
The other thing, John, is, you know, it's showing on Amazon Prime. Obviously, the films that we're reviewing are available online since cinemas are closed. But in America, it's been shown at drive-in movie theatres. This is a film made for drive-in movie, isn't it?
Can you imagine? Wouldn't it be just amazing? The atmosphere that Patterson is able to conjure on a very low budget. Now, he very cleverly cuts his cloth. There isn't money for elaborate CGI or pyrotechnics, so he keeps the flashy stuff to a minimum and emphasises the material that he can work with, predominantly the audio. The 1950s slang and the dialogue, rock and roll music, like you say, the hypnotic monologues, and an amazing use of music and sound, tones, frequencies, the human voice. All of those elements are brilliantly executed by what I thought was a young director with great promise, enormous promise.
All right. I think you both enjoyed this, if it did take you a little while to get there, Angela. So let's start with your stars on The Vast of Night. Angela?
Well, Sean, I would have to say that, you know, this has been critically very well received, but I don't think it's going to be everyone's cup of tea. I mean, I would love to go and see it. I'd love to go to a drive-in movie theatre and see it, listen through my radio. It's my kind of thing. If you like old B-movies, if you're into Americana, if you like the 50s, if you're a radio nerd, if you like David Lynch and the B-52s, you're going to love this. If you don't, I think you might find it contrived and pretentious and you may not get beyond the first 15 minutes of it. But I liked it, so I'm giving it 4 out of 5.
4 out of 5 from you. And what are you saying, John?
Well, what I liked most about it, Sean, was that it's told without the deadening thud of irony. These tropes that he's playing with are so ingrained in the culture, they've been referenced and satirized and postmoderned to death. And it's a brave filmmaker who tried to winkle them out and turn them into something new. And I think he did that. I think he succeeded in that. 4 stars for me. It's the best film I've seen since the lockdown began.
All
right. I really enjoyed it.
And if you want to see it, it's available on Amazon Prime from tomorrow, the 29th of May. I heard them talking about, that's The Fast of Night, I heard them talking about drive-in gigs in Limerick, in and around Dolan. So maybe drive-in movies will solve all of our cinema problems if somebody has the money and the inclination to go ahead with that. Let's move on then to The High Note, again available on Amazon Prime. Latest movie from director Nisha Ganatra shares a few of the themes she explored in her 2015 movie Late Night, which had Emma Thompson, kind of a story of a TV host whose star is waning. In High Note, youthful ambition clashes with fading stardom, not in the TV studio but on the music stage. Angela, whose star is waning in The High Note?
Yeah, it tells the story of legendary singer Grace Davis, who's played by Tracy Ellis Ross, who's the daughter of Diana Ross. And so, you know, she's struggling to get ahead in the man's world, as is her personal assistant. But the Grace's issue is that she hasn't written or sung any new material for years, and she's feeling quite, you know, creatively down in the dumps and defunct. And she's, shock horror, in her 40s. So the radio executives and her record company, basically, they just want to keep rolling out the greatest hits and live albums. And now, to top it all, they want her to go and do a residency in Las Vegas. Her personal assistant, Maggie, who is played by Dakota Johnson. Would rather be a music producer than a personal assistant. And so she feels that really Grace is selling out by doing this, and that, you know, there's still plenty of gas in the tank, and that she should reinvent herself, modernize herself. And she secretly starts to take edits of old Grace Davis tracks and to remaster them, and plays them to her boss. And will they go with it? No, they won't, because Grace's manager, Jack, who's played by Ice Cube, has, you know, thinks, who is this little imposter, and really she should go away. And both Grace and Maggie are patronised within an inch of their life by the men around them. Well, and that's
the basic premise of this one, for sure. Well, Ice Cube, as you said, plays the character of the music manager, Jack Robertson. Grace Davis, played by Tracy Ellis Ross. Dakota Johnson plays her assistant, Maggie. And let's hear a clip where precisely that kind of patronising that you talk about, Angela, is going on.
It's just one simple meet. The label guys want to know all about Vegas. You know what? Let's just talk about this later. Continue to do your ukulele shit.
I don't want to sit with a bunch of label guys who, what is it?
Have to be reminded
that I'm still alive.
What do we sit here and talk about?
I've already done a greatest hits album and a live album, and now a greatest hits live album? What?
Okay, look, when I agreed to come back, what did you promise me? Huh? You said you was gonna listen to me this time. All I wanna do is play it safe so we can stack some money.
It's pathetic.
You pathetic, because you arguing with me and your ass should be on vocal rest.
I will decide what I want to do next.
Yeah.
Give me the popsicles, Maggie.
Yeah.
You always walk away. Grace.
Ice Cube as music manager Jack Robertson there, Grace played by Tracy Ellis Ross, and Maggie, Grace's assistant, played by Dakota Johnson, doing the voicing for her, because poor old Grace has lost her voice at that point in time. We mentioned Diana Ross's daughter, who it is who's playing the character of Grace here, John, but the scriptwriter Flora Gleason, there are some parallels in her own story, and this is her debut screenplay.
As far as I know, it's her debut screenplay, but I didn't know anything about her as a writer or her previous career. It'd be really interesting if she did have the inside track on how music is made in Los Angeles and what happens when superannuated acts end up in Las Vegas doing karaoke for the buffet crowd, but I didn't really get any sense of that in Gantra's treatment of the film. It's ironic, really, that in a film that's ostensibly about the need to take risks to create art and to sacrifice comfort for the reward of making something new, that the high note is as formulaic as they come. It's as comfortable and easy a ride as you're going to get this year. Highly polished studio work, a bit of drama, a bit of light comedy, a little romance. Particularly the character played by Kelvin Harris Jr., the young singer that Maggie picks up on, starts working with him and leading to a kind of a standoff between these two women's varying ambitions. All of that is quite well worked because it fits a formula. But apart from that, there's not a lot here that we haven't seen before with interchangeable elements.
What about the music, Angela? Who performs the music actually here? Because there's a lot of live performance, or what looks like live performance at any rate.
Yeah, there is. I mean, there's. It's actually the first time that Tracy Ellis Ross has sung in a role, which is incredible considering she's in her late 40s. And I kept thinking back to Lady Sings the Blues, Diana Ross's debut as an actress in the early 70s, which I haven't seen for years, but remember loving it. I was much younger. I don't know if it stands the test of time. But Tracy Ellis Ross can sing. I'm just amazed that she has never done it before. And so she really, for me, if there is a star in this, it was her and what she did. And I thought there was great chemistry between her and Dakota Johnson as well. But I have to say, when you're asking about the music, as the film progresses, and no spoilers here, but as the story and the narrative progresses, and there's sort of the musical finale in particular is so saccharine. I mean, these people have got good voices, and obviously, you know, an awful lot went into the production of the music in this. The final, it's a duet. I won't say more than that, but it sounds like country music. I mean, it's so middle of the road. And as John says, you know, it really, in the end, you end up feeling that actually the film has gone the way that Grace was trying to avoid going with her career, which was just taking the money and run. Yeah. Because I couldn't figure out what this film was about. You know, I really thought, is it a drama? There's one really good scene in it where, you know, Grace has just been, I mean, really, really condescended to in a meeting room full of men. She goes into the bathroom and is in tears. And she launches into this monologue where she says to Maggie, you know how naive you are. There has never in the history of music been a number one hit by a woman over 40, a black woman over 40. So look at me, where am I going to go? You know, you need to wake up. And then you kind of think, that's what this film started out about. Like, you're suddenly reminded that that's what this was supposed to be about, these two women getting ahead. But basically, it falls into the hole, big, dark, black hole of a romantic comedy as soon as the male love interest enters. And then it just turns into a different film. So I really didn't know, is this a drama? Is it a rom-com? Is it a musical? And the writing is quite patchy as well. I mean, Ice Cube vanishes. The Jack character vanishes for a full half an hour in this film when the conflict that's set up initially and the sparks are flying are between Jack and Maggie, and then he disappears as soon as David, the love interest, arrives. And one or two other things about the writing that just didn't sit really well with me was that there were two actors in this that I was really excited to see in the cast. And they were Mark Evan Jackson, who plays the sort of slimy, radio company guy. People will know him as Sean, the main demon in The Good Place. He's the guy who presides over the bad place. And he's really good at sarcastic, unctuous type of characters. And then Eddie Izzard appears about two thirds of the way through it. And he's this kind of washed up looking rock star that's sort of overweight. And he kind of looks like an overweight, embittered David Bowie tribute act. And he's only there as a narrative device to get Maggie out of the spot of bother. He has about three lines and then he disappears, and it's just like, what? Come back, Eddie Izzard.
I felt disappointed by it. Because we'd be here all night. Even if Ganatra can't find a moment of genuine dramatic conflict, that she doesn't feel obliged to resolve completely to everybody's satisfaction a couple of scenes later. And that's what deadens a lot of the film, is the requirement for anything that's put forward to be tidily squared away a couple of scenes later. And it just reveals the formula at play, and that's a fatal kind of thing that you do in this kind of film. But there's a comfort in it. There's a comfort in it, and there's a joy in seeing it done well. And like Angela said, the regular music numbers are very distinctive, and Ross has a remarkable voice. But there's a lot else that they could have done a bit better.
Stars from you, John.
Oh, 3-3.
Three from you and average, from you, Angela.
Straight down the middle.
And you're listening to Thursday Night's Arena. Now, we've already spoken about The High Note and The Vast of Night in our movie reviews tonight. And when we were talking about The Vast of Night, by the way, I mentioned, wow, drive-in movies would be great to see that. Well, I am told in the last 10 minutes that there are some drive-in movies happening in June, in fact, in Kilkenny, Galway, Fairy House and Leopardstown. And the website to find out what movies are being shown there is retrodrivein.ie. So there you go. There's your big chance for a drive-in movie in the next month. Sure, it's only a couple of days away at this stage, isn't it? Now, let us move on to movie number three, Only the Animals, from the French film director Dominic Moll. The premise here, John, we're in the south of France, but a very cold south of France, certainly in the opening sections.
In the Central Massif of France, actually.
Oh,
showed,
sorry, beg your pardon.
Where a neighbour's car has been found on the side of the road by Alice, played by Laura Calamy, who's a married social worker who's having an affair with a client named Joseph, played by Damien Bronard. And when the cops question Joseph, he claims to know nothing about the missing driver, played by Valeria Brune Tedeschi, who was herself having an affair with a waitress, but in fact, her dead body is wrapped in a blanket in a press in his house. Now, this is all happening in the first couple of minutes of the film. I'm not revealing anything. The story is broken into five chapters titled after the characters' names, Alice, Michel, Joseph, and jumps backwards and forwards in time and backwards and forwards from France to Guyana in Africa, although the witting or unwitting involvement of some of the characters is something that we're not going to go into here. It's a bit beyond the scope of our synopsis. But still, why does Alice's husband, Michel, played by Denis Ménochet, who's the farmer, if you remember, in the opening scene of Tarantino's Inglourious Basterds, why does he have a cut on his face? What does an internet scammer sitting in Africa online, what does he have to do with any of this? And this is a very ambitiously structured thriller, a very well-staged thriller, like you say, from Dominic Moll, who people might remember 20 years ago made a film called Harry, He's Here to Help, which was another kind of Hitchcockian, fractured Hitchcockian thriller, and will appeal to fans of Rashomon or Memento or any of those kind of multilinear mysteries, but also TV shows like Broadchurch or Collateral, in which you have many characters playing a role in a central mystery, and we have to tease it out. And that's what, as I was watching it, and the way it's structured, all I could think of was Godard's famous maxim that a film should have a beginning, a middle and an end, but not necessarily in that order. And that's what Moll is playing around with here. And he does it very well. He does it extremely well.
Yes, but you do have to. I mean, I watched this late last evening and I found that, first of all, obviously you're dealing with subtitles because it's in French, but you are dealing with those backwards and forwards moments in time, Angela. And that does demand, if you found the first 20 minutes of The Vast of Night that you had to have your head screwed on, you certainly have to be, you have to concentrate as you're watching this. But again, I would argue there's a payoff.
Yeah, I do have to concentrate. I think you can just let it wash over you. I really enjoyed this because I love non-linear storytelling. I'm not a fan of the rising action and the beginning, middle and end and, you know, the three-act scenario. I don't particularly like that. I like to kind of, I find that I'm not often surprised by it, and very often I would guess what's going to happen, or I'd find myself trying to guess. You didn't get a chance with this film to do that because of all of the interconnected stories. You're just watching each person's story and suddenly you're going, oh, that's how they relate to the other person. And they're walking in and out of each other's stories and it's episodic and it flips, you know, it's non-linear. So it flips forwards and backwards in time. And often you see the same scene being played out again from the perspective of the other character. And I just found it really engaging. I enjoyed it so much. I think it was really controlled, well done. I didn't disbelieve it, except for the very final connection, which is the final scene. But the rest of it, I just completely suspended my disbelief and I was gone. I was going with him on this. Dominic Moll had me.
Yeah, and absolutely. You both, Angela and yourself, John, you both chose or singled out the performance of Denis Ménochet, who plays the character of Michel. Why was he so compelling for you, John?
Well, I've always liked him. Every time he pops up, the first time I saw him was in Inglourious Basterds, but I've seen him in a few films since, particularly a French film from a couple of years ago called Custody, in which he's just extraordinary. And he just has one of those faces, one of those bodies. He's like, a slightly lumpier, younger Gerard Depardieu. He's just come out compelling to look at. And as a fine actor, he's really good at playing the kind of character that he plays here, who is somebody who on the surface might seem beaten and cowed by the circumstances that he's in, but there is that spark of intelligence working behind that makes itself more apparent as the story goes on. Now, I found that some of the sections here are more effective than others, and one or two of them dragged for me a little bit, but there is an enormous satisfaction when the intricate logic that Maul is playing with, when it finally clicks into place. This is a complex story told without ever feeling the need to spoon-feed us the information. While we're busy solving the great mystery at the heart of the film, the disappearance of this woman and how she died, Maul is formulating a bigger mystery about how lust and greed warp people's minds and make them do things that they would otherwise never consider doing. And that's really good. That's really engaging adult grown-up drama and great fun to watch.
Yeah, and the other aspect of that is, Angela, it's based on a novel. And of course, you can flip back and forth in time in a novel, I think, an awful lot easier than you can do in film in some ways. Or certainly there are literary tricks that you can use to bring the reader along with you. Maul seems to have it. The adaptation seems to grasp all of that pretty well.
Well, I absolutely want to read the novel after reading it. It really made me wonder how faithful it was to the novel. The novel originally was written by Colin Nile, who I know absolutely nothing about, but I would certainly go out and buy it and read it. And there's layers happening here as well that I liked. It's a they're five love stories. You know, that's the thing. Yeah. All of these people just want to be loved. And all of them are kind of unlovable in their own way. And they're all chasing after an unattainable love. They've idealized love. You know, they're chasing after fantasies, and they all end up heartbroken or rejected and, well, you know, potentially dead.
Stars.
So
stars.
It's dark. It's definitely dark.
Stars from you,
four
Angela.
And a half for
four
me.
And a half
I loved
from
it.
Four and a half from Angela. And four from and you, John?
Well, four for me, Shauna. It's a top. This is A-list French cinema. This is as good as it gets at the moment.
Okay, John McGuire and Angela Flannery there. Only the Animals is available on Curzon Home Cinema, while the first two films we spoke about, Vast of Night and The High Note, are both available on Amazon Prime.